Thanks for listening to Press Play. If you're like me and you need help navigating the busy film award season, I have a podcast just for you. It's called The Treatment, and it's hosted by Elvis Mitchell. And Elvis really goes beyond the simple plot outline to understand what inspires the people who make these movies, the actors, the filmmakers, the producers. So check it out, The Treatment, on KCRW's iTunes page.
I prefer the concrete, the graspable, the provable.
You'd make a splendid computer, Mr. Spock.
That is very kind of you, Captain.
On my planet, to rest is to rest, to cease using energy. To me, it is quite illogical to run up and down on green grass using energy instead of saving it.
At times, you seem quite human.
Captain, I hardly believe that insults are within your prerogative as my commanding officer.
Sorry.
May I point out that I had an opportunity to observe your counterparts here quite closely. They were brutal, savage, unprincipled, uncivilized, treacherous. In every way, splendid examples of Homo sapiens, the very flower of humanity. I found them quite refreshing.
Leonard Nimoy playing Mr. Spock. He died at his home in Los Angeles today. He was 83. Nimoy had a long career as an actor. Of course, he was best known for playing that half-Vulcan, half-human first officer of the Starship Enterprise. His wife said he died of lung disease, which he attributed to years of smoking. Nimoy briefly distanced himself from Spock and then later embraced the role again. But he was a lot more than that. In real life, Nimoy was also a poet, a director, an author, a singer, and a photographer. We're going to remember Leonard Nimoy now with a couple of our regular film critics. Jenna Bush is founder of the Women in Sci-Fi community, Legions of Leia. Welcome, Jenna.
Thank you for having me.
And James Rocky, film critic who writes for The Wrap, Film.com, and others. Welcome back.
Thank you very kindly, Madeline.
Let's start with you, Jenna, and tell us, what was the genesis of the Spock character? How much of it was Leonard Nimoy, and how much of it was the show's creator, Gene Roddenberry?
Well, it was largely Roddenberry, but, you know, it's funny, he had actually looked at Nichelle Nichols for the role of Spock originally, and when he saw Leonard Nimoy, that was it. There was no one else up for the role. There was something about him that just absolutely embodied it.
Right. And so, James, talk a little bit more about that character and why it resonated so fully with people.
Well, we live in a day and age when I'm afraid iconic is applied to every random Kardashian and celebrity. But I can, like, put my palm towards you, split my fingers and raise an eyebrow, and you know who I'm talking about. And that's because Leonard Nimoy embodied all of Spock so well. He embraced the contradictions, he had fun with it, and he hit the perfect space operatic tone, and also built on the character with his own ideas. The traditional Vulcan salute is in fact adopted from Judaism, which he brought to it as the son of Ukrainian immigrants and Orthodox Jews. It's funny, early on, Nimoy studied acting at Pasadena Playhouse, and one of his earliest roles was Stanley in A Streetcar Named Desire, which seems almost impossible to imagine, which is kind of tribute to the work that he did.
Yeah, and Jenna, he recently, I mean, he briefly distanced himself, as I said earlier, from the Spock character, but then fully embraced it for most of his career, recently voicing an action figure in the TV show The Big Bang Theory, and let's listen to that.
Down here on your desk.
Spock?
I need to speak with you.
Fascinating. The only logical explanation is that this is a dream.
It is not the only logical explanation. For example, you could be hallucinating after being hit on the head by, say, a coconut.
Jenna, did he explain why he didn't distance himself from Mr. Spock, why he liked that character so much?
He didn't that much. You know, it's funny, I interviewed him a number of years ago when the reboot of Star Trek came out, and he talked a little bit to me about the book that he wrote, I Am Not Spock, in 1975, and then I Am Spock in 1995. And it seemed like there was a sort of a piece about accepting what he'd done and the influence that it had on people. He actually giggled about it when I interviewed him. And we actually talked about, I don't know how many of the listeners know about this, but he did a video, The Ballad of Bilbo Baggins, which is one of the funniest things I've ever watched on the internet. And he doubled over laughing when we talked about it. There just seemed to be a peace and a gentleness about him and an acceptance of what he's done for everyone who's involved in sci-fi.
And James, talk a little bit more about his projects outside of Mr. Spock. And I mean, he's astonishingly prolific acting.
He's an immensely talented director who could go from making Three Men and a Baby into a huge smash hit to then making The Good Mother, an incredibly sensitive drama about sex and parenting. He was the narrator for the popular In Search Of program in the 70s, and he was kind of America's ambassador to the supernatural, as every week he would narrate a search for the Nazca Lines or Sasquatch or a crystal skull. He was great in Invasion of a Body Snatchers 1978, playing a weird psychiatrist who may or may not be in on the Pod People conspiracy. He was terrific, and he brought that sense of intelligence and that dry diction to even the silliest material. What I would say is that, you know, William Shatner feels like he was in on the joke of being Captain Kirk, and he kind of hated it. Leonard Nimoy feels like he was in on the joke of being Spock and came to enjoy it and enjoy the things that it gave him.
And Jenna, what kind of influence did he have in the sci-fi world?
It's sort of mind-blowing. When this news woke me up this morning, and it took over the internet. It's his character is so interesting because Spock, though he didn't, the idea was to be rid of emotion. It was more fighting against it. And I think there's something about a character that constantly fights something that when you see little breaks of it, when you see little breaks of emotion, it does something to you. And his character, I mean, everything is based off of it. There's so many things that are based off of this. Even what he did in Fringe has influenced sci-fi, and he'll be incredibly missed.
The one thing I'd note is that Mr. Nimoy would always go out and talk about the Vulcan idea of infinite diversity in infinite combinations, which is utterly made up and utterly nonsense, but still an incredibly radical thing to be saying in the 1970s, which is why the Star Trek fan base includes so many gay and lesbian and other identified members, even though Roddenberry was always squeamish about that kind of stuff, in part to Mr. Nimoy making it a deliberately inclusive, progressive franchise through his words and through his interpretation of a character. That's a great legacy to have.
Right. And it was really the spirit, when you think of it, of Star Trek, is this kind of exploration, not necessarily of what's out there, but what's inside, what it is to be human.
And again, as Jenna said, the whole idea of, you know, the Vulcan idea that it's not suppression of emotion, but logical, rational control of it. You do get the fun of watching that break and the great comedy of when Spock would go on a bender for whatever plot reason. That's always fun to watch because he knew the character and he knew how to make it work.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us today to remember Leonard Nimoy.
Thank you, Ms. Brand, for a brief moment of happiness on a sad day.
Thank you for having us.
Jenna Bush is founder of the Women in Sci-Fi community, Legions of Leia, and James Rocky, film critic who writes for The Wrap, Film.com, and other publications. Do you have a favorite Leonard Nimoy moment? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Switching gears now, and we're going to talk about child sex trafficking. It's really a crime we often associate with countries far away, but it does happen here in Los Angeles, and there's a renewed interest by authorities to fight it. Last July, Los Angeles County DA Jackie Lacey created her office's first human trafficking unit to go after pimps who exploit minors. And several years ago, the county created a special court to handle cases involving sexually exploited girls. Now officials are talking about creating a special court inside the family court system that would try to help these kids before they're arrested on criminal charges. Leslie Starr Himoff is executive director of the Children's Law Center of Los Angeles. That's the court-appointed law firm for foster kids. And she joins us now to tell us more about this new court. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Well, first, how widespread in Los Angeles is this problem?
I'm sorry, you cut out. Can you ask the question again?
Sure. I just want to know the scope of the problem in Los Angeles.
Okay. Well, it's hard to say because we have only recently begun to be able to identify youth, but we know that there are approximately 200 children arrested for prostitution annually. That number is very low. That's in Los Angeles. That number is low, though, because what we're finding is that now that the social workers and probation officers and lawyers and judges are learning to identify trafficking in a way that we were never aware of before, many children are not identified until either after they're arrested for a different crime, for example, a carjacking or a robbery or an assault, and it's after they're in juvenile hall that we learn that they have actually been trafficked. And similarly, on the foster care side, the estimates are that 50 to 80% of all girls who are trafficked have some connection to the child welfare system or to the foster care system. And what we are learning is that when girls are either perhaps they've run away or they're between placements or things are not going well, and we weren't asking what was going on when they were out on the street, and now that we're asking, we're finding that many girls have been trafficked, but fortunately we're not arrested, and unfortunately though we're also not receiving treatment or proper care and supervision to keep them safe.
So what are some of the red flags? What are the things that you ask now that maybe you didn't ask a few years ago to find out if a child has been trafficked?
So for starters, especially when a young person has been away from her placement, say she wasn't in the foster home or she was out on the street or didn't come home at the time she was supposed to, I'm asking, you know, how she ate while she was away and where did she stay, and if maybe her nails are done, who paid for you to get your nails done, where'd you get the clothes that you're wearing? And then if the answer is my boyfriend, we've also learned that boyfriend is often code for pimp, and they won't say my pimp or my trafficker, but they may say my boyfriend. So we're learning to look behind that a little bit more and ask us, you know, tell me about your boyfriend. How old is he? What's his name? Where does he live? Do you think he'd come to a meeting so that we can all get together and see how we can make a plan to keep you safe? Things like that are helping us to identify girls who have been exploited or trafficked and may not even themselves realize what the exploitation is really all about.
So how does it happen that 50 to 80% of the trafficked girls, and is it mostly girls?
Yes.
Come from the child welfare system, from foster care. What's the link there?
Well, the link is probably best described by one of our young people who very eloquently said in an interview that foster care, in her words, was the perfect training ground for being exploited, because I was used to living with people who only took care of me when they were being paid to take care of me. Sexually abused as a child, she was used to people taking from her literally, you know, taking her body without her consent and without her permission. And so going from placement to placement, never knowing where home was going to be, all of those things, in her words, were perfect preparation. The other piece of it is that unfortunately, children who have not been well served either by the foster care system or who were hurt within their own families, they believe it when someone says, they want to believe it when someone says, I care about you, I love you, I think you're very special and you're going to be special to me. And it starts out very well. Typically, the exploiter begins with a grooming process where she really is treated like his girlfriend, and he does buy her nice things and is kind to her and tells her how special she is and that he really loves her. As that relationship flourishes, then he says, but baby, you know, I need you to do this for me. I need you to do that for me. I need you to do this for our family. So it's a gradual process, and there really is a brainwashing that's involved.
And typically, how old are these girls?
The average age of entry into trafficking is estimated to be 12 years old. And that applies both for adult women who are in the commercial sex trade, as well as for children. So in research that's been done in talking to women anywhere from the age of 12 on up to 20 or 30 or 40, the average age of entry for all of them is 12.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about this new court, and what would it do that is not being done now?
So in our dependency courts now, this new court would only be on the dependency side, or what we call what the public might think of as the child welfare side. So this court would be for girls who have not been arrested, who are not engaged or involved in the delinquency courts. They are only involved with the courts because they themselves have been abused or neglected within their family. So they're now living in foster care or with relatives, but are now being exploited. In our courts now, the caseloads are crushing. The LA courts are severely underfunded, the LA dependency courts. So there's very little time. Children come to court approximately every 6 months. We only have a few minutes in front of the judge, and it's extremely difficult for folks to stay on top of all of their needs. If we're able to secure the necessary funding and staffing for this new court, it would allow for smaller caseloads. It would allow for the judges and the lawyers and the social workers that are connected with that court to have special training and to develop an expertise. The girls would come to court, ideally, in my mind, every 2 weeks or so that we could keep really close tabs on the case. We could really strengthen our relationship with the client, which is so important because the relationship with their exploiter is often the strongest tie they have, and we need to replace that relationship with caring adults that are going to be there and be consistent for the young person. You know, when with these girls, when opportunity knocks, we have to answer the door because the window, it closes very quickly. Similar to victims of domestic violence, it's not uncommon for someone who's been exploited to go back to their exploiter because there's this dependent emotional relationship. Mm-hmm. So we have to be ever present and attending to all of their needs in real time. And we can't tell them, come back next week, come back next month. We have to wait a few months for this or that because we'll lose them.
Leslie Starheimoff, Executive Director of the Children's Law Center of Los Angeles. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on the program, how the Americans won an extremely unlikely victory in Sweden in cross-country skiing. That story is next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry, you can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. And let me tell you something. An amazing thing happened this week. Wait for it. I'm guessing maybe not many of you have been watching the World Championships of Nordic Skiing. Well, they have been going on for more than a week in Falun, Sweden. And that means cross-country skiing, ski jumping, and for men, a combination of the two. Well, cross-country skiing, not such a big sport here in the U.S. In fact, no American woman skier has ever won a medal in a distance race at the World Championships. That is, until now. This week, two women from the American ski team won the silver and bronze medals in the 10-kilometer race. And it was an earth-shaking moment in the world of Nordic sports because, well, the Scandinavian teams, they take their cross-country very seriously. The Americans, in this case, are basically the bad news bears of the sport. And our Press Play producer covering all things snow sports related, Christian Bordahl, is here now to tell us about this momentous occasion.
Yes, I'm glad you gave it the grandeur that it's due, Madeline.
I know. Well, you are Norwegian, so
I am.
I feel your awe of what happened. And so the American skier who won the silver medal in that race, you spoke with her. Who is she?
I did. Her name's Jessie Diggins. She's 23 years old. She's from a little town called Afton in Minnesota, not too far from Minneapolis. She did very well as, you know, she started skiing when she was a little child and her parents are really into it. She actually won a state championship when she was in high school. And then after high school, she decided to take a year off and try being a pro at cross-country skiing. And so she went on the circuit. She got onto the U.S. cross-country ski team after about a year. And then in the last couple of years, she's actually established herself on the World Cup circuit, which is no mean feat for an American skier. And a couple of years ago in the World Championships, she and another American skier called Keegan Randall, they're both sprinters primarily, won a gold medal in the World Championships and the team sprints. And that was the first gold medal that the U.S. had ever won in any World Championships for women. So she, you know, she's a really good skier, and she had a particularly good race this week in the 10 kilometers.
It must be kind of weird for her to be so good in a sport that few Americans really care about.
Yeah, I had exactly the same thought, and I asked her about exactly that, and this is what she had to say.
back in the United States, a lot of people don't even know what cross-country skiing is. And how could they when, you know, half the country doesn't get snow? But when we go over to Europe, it's a huge sport over there. I mean, they sold 200,000 tickets to the stadium here in Sweden for the World Championships. And it's like, people over here, it's the biggest sport in Scandinavia, basically. And I mean, the skiers on the national teams for Sweden and Norway, they are heroes. It's amazing. It's really cool because you come over here and suddenly you feel like you're, you know, playing in the Super Bowl or something. And that energy is just really amazing.
Okay, so they take their sports really seriously there.
They
in Sweden, their winter sports. So tell us about this race. What happened about the upset?
So one thing that you need to understand about this race is there were 71 races in this race. It's a big field. And they don't all go out at once in one pack. It's what's called a time trial. So every racer goes out like 30 seconds after the racer before them. So one racer goes out, you wait 30 seconds, the next racer goes out. It's like this long chain of racers going through the course. And so it's a 10K race. That means it's about 6 miles. Diggins took about 25 minutes to cover that ground. So she's going at about a 4-minute mile pace. It's really fast. They're going through the forest, up and down big hills. And all along the trail, you know, it's not just tens of thousands of people in the stadium, but all along the trail, you have all of these people yelling encouragement and ringing their cowbells. It's really, really exciting. And this is how she described it.
It was a crazy day out there. It started snowing really hard, and I was getting splits from coaches during the race, so I knew it was good because coaches from the United States and other nations were freaking out on the side of the course, running next to me, and the fans were going crazy. But I didn't know how good the race was because I thought, oh, well, the people coming behind me will surely come past me because it's a time trial format. But when I crossed the line, I was almost blacked out. I was in so much pain, and once I recovered and it started to kind of sink in that this was just an amazing day, and our wax service team had given us these incredible skis, which opened up this opportunity for us to have an amazing race.
So she didn't even know how well she had done.
That's one of the really exciting things about this race. As I said, there were 71 races. She was bib number 37, so she goes out sort of in the middle of the pack. So when she crossed the line, she was first. She was in first place. She had beaten all of the races that went out before her. But there's still all the best races to come because the seeded group of races, the strongest races, go later in the race. So she's expecting that, you know, these people are going to come and beat her, right? But it's also kind of fun when you are in that first place, you get sort of special treatment when you finish the race. And here's what she said about that.
Yeah, I was first, which meant that I got to go sit in the leader's chair, which was really cool. It's this chair, almost like a throne type thing, covered in fur, and they have this big split board in front of you so you can watch the race and know exactly what's happening on the course, and they have cameras on you, and it's just this crazy thing where you're sitting there waiting and waiting and just watching and hoping that you'll stay in that chair.
All right, so tell us about the upset. Why did it happen?
So she mentioned two important things there, snow and wax. So the first thing that happened in this race, it started snowing really heavily. And that has a big impact on the way the race works. So when it's much faster when it's icy and hard conditions, the snow comes, you have to work harder. It slows you down. When you're going downhill, you don't glide as fast. And then the other thing she mentioned is that the waxes for the Norwegians did not do a very good job. This was like Sochi. You remember when we were talking about Sochi and there were some races where the Norwegians did really badly.
The Winter Olympics in Russia.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So this was kind of like that. The Norwegian waxes just didn't get the conditions right for the Norwegian skis.
But how could that be if this is their national winter sport?
It's kind of amazing. You know, the Norwegians come to these events with this huge bus that is basically like a great big state-of-the-art workshop for just dealing with skis. And they have, you know, dozens of people that are just there doing this technical work on the skis. But sometimes, all of that manpower gets it wrong. Like maybe there are too many cooks in the kitchen. The U.S. had 4 people there working on skis, and then they had another 6 volunteers, people who took vacation time just to go to Sweden and help out waxing skis for their skiers. So you get some idea of the discrepancy between the two teams. And, the U.S. just got it right. They had great skis, and they were a little bit lucky because they got out early, and they didn't have to deal with quite as much snow as some of the other contestants.
Okay, so the reaction on the part of the Norwegians was what?
they were calling for the head of the head waxing guy, as they did during Sochi, during the Olympics. They were, you know, they were up in arms. It's yet again, Schmerzabort, they call it. They managed to wax themselves out of it. They did such a bad job on the skis. And, you know, someone's got to pay for this national tragedy that occurred.
Well, so did they manage to turn it around at all?
They did. You don't have to feel sorry for them.
Okay. In the beginning, I don't.
Okay. So in the beginning, you know, they won all the sprint races, men's and women's. Today, they won the men's relay. Yesterday, they won the women's relay. By the way, the U.S. women came in fourth, which is really good in the relay. They beat out the Russians and the Germans and the French and the Italians, which is, you know, no mean feat. So it's been a really fun competition to watch.
How would you say better luck next time in Norwegian?
Håper det går bedre neste gang.
Christian Bordahl, Press Play producer from Norway, originally covering the ski beat. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Try to say that three times fast. Our Friday film segment is coming up with Alonzo Duralde and Dave White. We'll find out what they think of David Cronenberg's satire of Hollywood, among other new releases. That's after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, you can officially stop watching the most prestigious movies of 2014. The Oscars are over. Thank goodness. It's time to move into 2015 in earnest. And we've got all the details on the new releases out this week. Dave White is here, film critic for Movies.com. Hello there.
Howdy.
And Alonzo Duralde, chief film critic for The Wrap. Hello there.
Hello.
All right. Well, first, let's talk about Will Smith and his con man caper. It's called Focus, and here's a clip.
Oh, my God. Wait.
Whoa.
Here, just let him go.
Give me one reason why I shouldn't do it.
I'm drawing a blank.
What?
I think you should shoot me. You'd really be doing me a favor. Cancer. Tumor the size of a peach.
He's on to us.
Oh. You guys suck.
Just give us the money.
Or what?
Or he's gonna shoot you in the neck.
I wanna shoot a guy with cancer? Grandma Mikulski had cancer.
He doesn't have cancer, you idiot.
You guys really boned this thing. First of all, you gotta wait till she gets my pants off. And then you got to give me a chance to run. That's how you get the money. And you never drop the con. You never break. Die with the lie.
Okay, Will Smith there and co-starring Margot Robbie. What is this one about, Dave?
Well, he is a veteran con man. He comes from a long line of them. And she is a pretty good pickpocket that she would like to, you know, be in on the big con. And he's so committed to this life that when they meet, he is lying to her, but she is also lying to him.
What?
Yes.
A double con?
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, a lot of movies like this, once I realize that it's just going to be one sort of fool ya after another, I'll just sort of cross my arms and wait for the last 5 minutes when everything is explained. This movie is smart in that it has a lot of little cons along the way. So you're not just waiting for one big reveal at the end. There's a constant sense of, oh, nope, that was actually, oh, no, and this too. And the film, what I think when it works best, it fools the audience pretty well, not just in the standard sense of the characters are saying things that wind up not being true. There are even filmmaking techniques, and I'm not going to get into what they are, where I remember sitting there thinking, oh, that's a lazy choice. And then I realized later, oh, no, you did that on purpose, and it was part of the overall, oh, that's great. You know, there aren't enough of those moments, but there are some of them. This movie is written and directed by the team who wrote Bad Santa, and they wrote and directed Crazy Stupid Love, and I Love You, Philip Morris. I Love You, Philip Morris is a much better movie about sort of flim-flammery. But this one has its charm. You know, it's a pleasant enough sort of February diversion.
Well, in these kinds of movies, it really relies on the chemistry between the stars, right? And
sure.
Is there chemistry between the two of them?
There is.
Yeah.
I was going to say, you enjoyed this a lot more than I did. There are not enough of those moments, as you said. There sure are not enough of those moments. The stars do have chemistry together. In fact, it is at its most alive when they are on screen together. You know, she has this newcomer's sort of hunger and hardness that bounces off of him very well, because he's very sort of impenetrable and cool, and he's Will Smith, you know. Is there another actor in the past two decades that's more charismatic than Will Smith? Not really.
Probably.
It's
nice to see this Will Smith back after Earth.
Is this the Men in Black Will Smith?
It's a little less jokey than that, but it's definitely, there is a cool and a casualness in front of the camera, and it allows him to be both the kind of sort of, you know, jokey two steps ahead of you guy, but then also occasionally the, you know, the sort of pained romantic as well. So he's fun to watch. The two of them are charming together. Yeah, she's. I hope that Margot Robbie was in Wolf of Wall Street. That was kind of her big thing before now. I hope that she reaches a stage where she kind of comes into her own as an actress. I was reminded a lot of other people while watching her in this movie. She looks a lot like Jamie Presley. She sounds a lot like Emma Stone. But, you know, this is the sort of thing where this is going to be Charlize Theron in the Mighty Joe Young years, you know, where she's just sort of like, she's pretty, let's put her on in movies.
Let's see if we can make her a big star.
And then, yeah, later she may actually sort of, you know, emerge as something else.
I wanted it to be less of a locked box of puzzles. You know, everyone in the movie knows what's happening. You don't. You have to sit back and wait for them to tell you what just happened.
Well, sometimes that can be fun, like in House of Games.
Right,
sure.
The David Mamet movie.
Right, right. Yeah, if you're a fan of House of Games or Spanish Prisoner, that kind of film, again, this is not nearly at that level, but it's, you know, you'll have some fun.
Okay, let's move on to a Hollywood satire, I guess.
Sure.
Would you call that a satire? Well, let's see. We'll talk about it. David Cronenberg's new movie. It's called Maps to the Stars, and it stars Julianne Moore.
I thought that it was a meet. I didn't know that I was going to have to read. And then the casting director, who I know, doesn't even acknowledge me. She just walks right by without saying a word. And then she says they want to put me on tape. And I'm like, excuse me, but you need special makeup for that, or you look green. And she says, well, you can either tape or not. Like, it's all some pointless exercise. And I just can't take it anymore, Jacob. I'm so tired, and it's so pathetic.
Okay, she kind of looks like Lindsay Lohan and maybe sort of sounds like Lindsay Lohan in that.
On
purpose?
A case could be made.
Yeah.
And is it a satire?
Well, I think if you live here, it's a documentary. No, it is.
And I don't think you're right about that.
Kidding. It's hard to satirize Hollywood because, you know, the reality itself has gotten so bizarre.
And Hollywood loves to hate itself.
Yes, definitely. This is very much sort of a self.
Birdman. There you go.
Yeah, this is a self-imposed poison pill. It's written by Bruce Wagner, who did Wild Palms, and, you know, has specializes in this particular kind of sort of LA, you know, parody. You know, it is weirdly dark in a Cronenbergian way, not in the, you know, inserting things into your spinal column way, but definitely in the sort of dark passions and you know, damaged characters who I think all seem to fit the Hollywood milieu rather fittingly in a way, you know.
And the plot is basically aging movie actress wants to
play her mother in a movie, or play the role that made her mother famous in a reboot. It was never quite clear on which of those things it was. And then,
she refers to it as a reimagining.
Right, yes. Yeah. And meanwhile, Mia Wasikowska plays sort of a mysterious young woman who comes to town, and her return causes a lot of agita for a teen star and his parents.
Uh-huh.
It is, in how I feel about this, it's David Cronenberg's return to horror.
Not intentionally.
It, satirical as it may have looked on the page, it plays in this very sort of deadpan, brutal
Hollywood gothic
way. And nobody gets out all that happily at the end. And as a film about the dark side of Hollywood, and as a film with that approach, I couldn't help but think of an early 70s film based on Joan Didion's book, Play It As It Lays. Mm-hmm. And it's just not an easy film to find these days. But it's the greatest deadpan Hollywood sucks movie that there is. And
a character even says play it as it lays at one point in this film.
Really?
And so, you know, don't
never cite the better movie in your movie. Never have a scene where your characters go see Casablanca, because then the audience thinks, why aren't I watching Casablanca right now?
Maybe it's because we're film critics, but we have to see all the films about Hollywood that Hollywood makes about itself. And a lot of the stuff in this movie felt a little on the nose and obvious. You know, it's like, oh, well, you know, child stars are messed up and their families are weird and this aging actress can't get a job and she's desperate. And, you know, Lisa Kudrow has a sitcom about this on HBO.
Sunset Boulevard was made a long time ago.
You know, the self-help gurus will exploit their gullible clients, yada, yada, yada.
If you want to walk out of this, if you want to go to a film that'll make you actually feel genuinely bad, when it's done, this is your movie. But I don't know if it's...
Or we could stay home and watch House of Cards.
I don't know if it's worth the time for what you're going to wind up feeling like when it's over. Yeah.
All right, let's move on to something a little more warm and fuzzy. McFarland, USA. It's a David and Goliath sports movie set in California's Central Valley. Here's a clip.
We have kids here who seem like they can run forever. They carb load on rice and beans. I mean, they pick in extreme heat. They go to school all day. Some of them even run home. I've seen it. And it's unbelievable.
Yeah. And you've just described half the kids in the Central Valley. Jim, let me ask you something. You've coached cross country before?
No.
Track?
No.
But you ran? Competed in high school, maybe?
No.
Well, you sound perfect.
Kevin Costner in a sports movie. Wow. Something new. Dave White?
You see the trailer for this film and you think, I already know this movie. And on one level, you do. It's an inspirational sports film from Disney. They can do this in their sleep, and sometimes they have.
They've built it, and we've come.
Yeah. And then there's Kevin Costner, who knows from being the white savior in films. I mean, he made Dances with Wolves. And so... you walk in thinking, all right, I'm ready. I've seen Black or White. I'm ready to be offended again by this. And it's not that film. It's something else. It is the true story of a coach whose name was Jim White. I say was. He's still alive. In the late 80s, no relation. It's a very common surname, by the way. He shows up in McFarland, California, which is in the Central Valley, and he recruits all of these kids from their failing football team. All the kids are the children of migrant workers. And he says, well, what if we had a cross-country team? You know, you guys run everywhere you go, and you're fast, so why don't we do this? And they do it. And for the next, whatever, something like 14 years, he leads them to something like 10 state championships. It's a true story. But what's interesting about this movie is not that the white teacher comes in and fixes all the lives of the Mexican kids. What the story tends to really often be about is this teacher and his family who come into a place where they are the aliens and they have to sort of, they are very patiently and slowly welcomed and taught things about the community and about the people who live there. And about the kids' lives. It is as much about the kids as it is about Kevin Costner, although you wouldn't know that from the trailer. It's very sweet. It's very sincere. It's you know, it plays by the sports movie book, but it's lovely. And so, yeah, you know, give this one a shot.
Wow. Okay.
From the director of Whale Rider.
Yes.
I am surprised, pleasantly surprised by your review. All right. Let's also end on a sad but up note and remember Leonard Nimoy.
What a career. Obviously, of course, you know, first and foremost, forever Mr. Spock. But you start digging into the deep cuts. This guy was in two films based on plays by Jean Genet, one of which he produced. Mm-hmm. He, according to his Wikipedia page, directed the Bengals video for Going Down to Liverpool.
And that's awesome.
You know, he directed the highest grossing film of 1987, Three Men and a Baby.
He wrote poetry. He was a photographer.
He sang the ballad of Bilbo Baggins. Yes. I mean, come on. Yeah, just this sort of Renaissance man that we don't really get anymore. You know, these are the kind of this is sort of like, you know, when Mickey Rooney died, that was sort of the last of the vaudevillians. But now I think the generation that Nimoy was part of you know, it was that sort of post-World War II thing where you could, you know, go to New York and you know, study acting or the Pasadena Playhouse and then, you know, do all these amazing TV appearances and you know, do theater and mm-hmm. write and all this stuff. And I feel like there's, you know, we pass this way but once. I don't know that we're getting this kind of well-rounded, fascinating life sort of, you know, actors anymore. And yeah, he just did it all.
He was very cool. Yes, you're holding yeah. You're holding a finger thing,
which he apparently made up.
The live long and prosper, the Vulcan sign. Finger thing, yes. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll remember Leonard Nimoy fondly.
Absolutely.
As we head into the weekend, I want to thank you both very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
That's Alonzo Duralde, chief film critic for The Wrap, and Dave White, film critic for Movies.com. And together, they host the Linoleum Knife podcast. KCRW's on Vulcan. Warren Olney is here. But you're all human.
Thank you
you're
for that.
All
That's
human.
A real compliment.
Yes.
We're going to be talking about net neutrality. The battle is still on, even though the FCC made a decision yesterday. We'll have two former members of the FCC, one Democrat, one Republican, and they're going to go at it. You know, they really feel strongly about it, although, of course, they're old friends. So they say, you know, it's like lawyers after the case is over. But when the case is on, they have
the
interesting conversations. And we'll hear about Hollywood and why it's so important there and to the creative community in general.
Okay, that's a good, relevant conversation to tune in to at 1 o'clock, 15 minutes from now. Warren Olney, and To the Point. Thank you.
Okay.
And coming up on this program, a comic book anti-hero that some women are embracing. They say she's a refreshing antidote to Wonder Woman. Her name? Harley Quinn. Next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. One of the movies we talked about before the break, Focus, starring Margot Robbie. And Robbie's really on her way to becoming a big star. Next year, she'll star in the comic book crossover film Suicide Squad as Harley Quinn. Who's Harley Quinn, you ask? Well, there are lots of admirable female characters in comics these days. The Justice League's Black Canary, the X-Men's Jean Grey, and of course Wonder Woman. But Harley Quinn, she's not one of them.
Miss Quinn.
Don't you knock before entering a lady's boudoir?
I need help.
Well, you've come to the right place. I recommend a lobotomy.
The Joker's stolen a bomb. If I can't get to him in time, this city and everyone in it's going up in a mushroom cloud.
So you want me to turn squealer on Mr. J? Ha! Sorry, B-Man. No deal.
You help me find the Joker, and they'll write your ticket out of here.
Whee!
If you promise no double cross.
Ah, shoot, take all the fun out of life.
She's sweet, she's a sociopath, and she's managed to weasel her way into the hearts of comic book fans everywhere and become one of the biggest new characters to come along in years. Abraham Reisman is an editor at New York Magazine. He's written about Harley and how she's become one of the best of the female baddies at Vulture.com. Hi there.
Hello.
Well, tell us more about Harley Quinn, to be frank. And I know she's big in the comic book world, but she's not a household name. I had never heard of her.
Not just in the comic book world. Across the world of superhero fiction, she is one of the most popular and successful female characters. In fact, within the world of comics, she is arguably the best-selling character who is a woman right now. Her solo title, also called Harley Quinn, cracks the top 15 in comic sales month after month. That is not true of any other female-led book. And she is, as you said, a relatively new character. You know, the Batman mythos has been around for 75-odd years now. And Harley was introduced into the world of Batman in the cartoon Batman the Animated Series. And that show debuted in 1992, and she was in it very early on. But, you know, that's a good 50 plus years into that whole universe's existence. But she instantly struck a chord with people who were watching the cartoon and has really just been on a roll ever since.
Okay, so just to describe Harley Quinn, play on words, kind of obvious. She looks like Harley Quinn.
So. She looks like a Harlequin, yes. She is, at a very basic level, a sidekick of the Joker. And the Joker, of course, being the longtime arch nemesis of Batman, the clown prince of crime. And she is, in addition to being his sidekick, also his on-again, off-again girlfriend. And what really sets her apart from other female characters out there is her being involved with the Joker is a really bad decision. She's hopelessly in love with this guy, but he is about as abusive as you could imagine a guy being. I mean, given the fact that he's a sociopathic mass murdering clown, I suppose that's no surprise. But she sticks with him. There are times when she gets fed up and leaves, but she always comes back in one form or another. And that cyclical abusive relationship is something that's pretty unique in comics. And it's fascinating to see how much people have gravitated towards it.
Okay, so before we get to that, I just want to get one more fascinating detail from you about her origins, because she originated as a soap opera character.
Sort of, yes. So the actress who voiced her on the cartoon, a woman named Arlene Sorkin, was a longtime comedy writer and performer who had had a long period of time as one of the stars of Days of Our Lives, where she played this character called Calliope Jones, who was used for comic relief. And, you know, she was this sort of ditzy New York accented lady who in one episode appeared in clown makeup. There was this dream sequence where all the characters were in this sort of fake fairy tale thing. It had actually been Arlene's idea.
Okay, two drummer boys going to a bar. Ba-dum-ba-dum-bum. Boy, you're a rough crowd. You forceth me to shoot at you the moon.
And Arlene and Paul Dini, one of the lead writers for Batman the Animated Series, had gone to college together. And she made a little VHS tape for him once that had some of her favorite Days of Our Lives moments on it. And he, years later, in 1991, was sick as a dog, staying at home, and popped in the VHS tape just because he was bored. And happened to see that dream sequence where she was dressed up as a clown. And at that time, he was trying to write an episode of Batman the Animated Series where there was a female sidekick. He didn't know what to do with this character. And boom, he sees his old friend Arlene in clown makeup doing weird borscht belt gags. And he had inspiration that came from this longtime friendship. And all of a sudden, the character popped into his brain. He did a little sketch, gave it to the lead animator. The lead animator didn't like it and redrew it. And then you had this iconic costume that has been a part of her identity ever since.
And Arlene Sorkin, she was the voice, right?
Yes, she was. She went on to be the voice of Harley Quinn. And because this is a character who originated on a cartoon, her voice was so central to everyone's conception of this character.
Yeah, kind of a 40s Judy Holliday,
this,
kind of borscht.
Yeah, Judy
out.
Holliday.
Hey, wisecracking. Yeah.
Right. And that's Arlene's voice. You know, I interviewed her and it's very surreal as somebody who grew up watching the cartoon. It's very odd to have a conversation with Arlene Sorkin.
OK, so talk a little bit more about this complicated relationship that Harley Quinn has with the Joker and with her female fans, because she is, when you look at it, she's really an abused woman who keeps coming back for more.
You presume to tell me what I should think is funny? In fact, when have you ever contributed a worthwhile idea to this gang?
Well, I did get us away from Batman.
Oh, huzzah! The kid gets lucky and she wants a medal.
And then in her later iterations, like at first she's not overly sexualized, but then as she becomes a video game character, she becomes really sexualized.
How do you like my new uniform? Pretty hot, huh?
And then even later in later comics, it's kind of amazing. She's hardly wearing anything at all.
Right. So there's this complicated relationship that Harley has with feminism and the way that feminists think about comics. There are legions of Harley fans out there who are women who, although the character is a woman who has suffered abuse and who makes bad decisions, they strongly identify with her, or perhaps more importantly, really enjoy the fact that she is a character who gets to make those bad decisions. There are so many female characters in comics and in superhero fiction who are, you know, tough as nails ladies who, if they have any flaw, it's that they work too hard or they care too much. And Harley is one of the only female characters. She makes mistakes. She does not live her life in an admirable way. But at the same time, she's fun. She's interesting. She's fleshed out. even when she's not overtly sexualized, she does have this romantic aspect to her that is not present in a lot of female characters. And so there are a lot of female fans who not only identify with her and enjoy her, but say, well, this is a real feminist depiction of a character because she gets to make mistakes. She is not an idealized statue goddess in the way that Wonder Woman is, for example.
Well, thanks so much for the Harley Quinn primer.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
That's Abraham Reisman. He wrote an article for Vulture.com, The Hidden Story of Harley Quinn and How She Became the Superhero World's Most Successful Woman. Hi, Julie Myers.
I'm back.
Are you welcome back? Are you team Harley Quinn?
Of course. I am Press Play's very own Harley Quinn. Although I have not been overtly sexualized yet, I think. I'm going to move on quickly from that.
Yes.
Back to sad news. Leonard Nimoy passed away. Right. And of course, our listeners had plenty to say about him and his career. Anna Rose on Facebook says that the world just lost a wonderful human being. And even though she never met him, he was a major influence in her life. Susan called in and she wanted to share her personal memories of Leonard Nimoy. She went to school with his kids. And every year at the school, they had a big formal dance with celebrity DJs. And all the parents came to it, including Mr. Nimoy.
He would come wearing a full tuxedo, and he was a consummate gentleman. He was just soft-spoken and nice and such a whole different side of him than what we saw in his role as Mr. Spock. What a lovely human being, and what a huge loss, not only as an actor and poet, but also as a human being. I will miss him very much.
Balin Singh on Facebook points out that Nimoy embodied his signature line incredibly well. He did indeed live long and he prospered. And I just wanted to read the final tweet from Leonard Nimoy. He says, "A life is like a garden. Perfect moments can be had, but not preserved except in memory."
Oh, that's a perfect summing up. Well, thank you, Julie Myers.
Of course.
And that's the end of our show. Cannot be preserved. Well, maybe it can on the web. You can go back and listen whenever you want. And we will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Madeline Brand.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation. Rick and Suzanne Kane and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.